It is a battle which began nearly 120 years ago, at the moment when the Jew was granted citizen rights in the European states. The political emancipation of the Jews was the beginning of an attack of delirium, for thereby they were given full citizen rights and equality to a people which was much more clearly and definitely a race apart than all others, that has always formed and will form a state within the state. That did not happen perhaps at one blow, but it came about as things come about today, and always do come about. First a little finger, then a second, and a third, and so bit by bit, until at last, a people that in the 18th century still appeared completely alien had won equal citizen rights with ourselves. And it was precisely the same in the economic sphere. The vast process of the industrialization of the peoples meant the confluence of great masses of workmen in the towns. Thus, great hordes of people arose. And these, more's the pity, were not properly dealt with by those whose moral duty it was to concern themselves for their welfare. Parallel with this was a gradual moneyfication of the whole of the nation's labor strength. Share capital was in the ascendant, and thus bit by bit, the stock exchange came to control the whole national economy. The directors of these institutions were, and are without exception, Jews. I say without exception, for the few non-Jews who had a share in them are in the last resort nothing but screens, shop window Christians, whom one needs in order, for the sake of the masses, to keep up the appearance that these institutions were, after all, founded as a natural outcome of the needs and the economic life of all peoples alike, and were not, as was the fact, institutions which correspond only with the essential characteristics of the Jewish people and are the outcome of those characteristics. Then Europe stood at the parting of the ways. Europe began to divide into two halves, into West Europe and Central and Eastern Europe. At first, Western Europe took the lead in the process of industrialization. Especially in England, crowds of farm laborers, sons of farmers, or even ruined farmers themselves, streamed into the towns and there formed a new fourth estate. But here one fact is of more importance than we are accustomed to admit. This England, like France, had relatively few Jews. And the consequence of that was that the great masses concentrated in the towns did not come into immediate contact with this alien nation. And thus, feelings of aversion which must otherwise necessarily have arisen did not find sufficient nourishment for their development. In the end, the 50 or 60,000 Jews in England, there was hardly that number in England then, with supreme ease were able to Europeanize themselves, that they remained hidden from the primitive eye of the ordinary member of the public, and as captains of industry, and especially as representatives of capital on a large scale. They could appear no longer as foreigners, but themselves became Englishmen. This accounts for the fact that anti-Semitism in these states could never attain to any native vigor, for the same is true of France. And precisely for this reason, in these countries, it was possible to introduce the system which we have to represent to ourselves under the concept of democracy. There it was possible to create a state form whose meaning could only be the mastery of the herd over the intelligentsia, the mastery over true energy through the dead weight of massed numbers. In other words, it must be supremely easy for the Jewish intelligentsia, small in numbers and therefore completely hidden in the body of the British people, so to work upon the masses that the latter, quite unconscious of whom they were obeying, in the end did but serve the purposes of this small stratum of society. Through the press propaganda, through the use of the organs of information, it was possible in England to found the great model parties. Already in those early days, they saw to it shrewdly that here were always two or three groups apparently hostile to each other. But in fact, all hanging on a gold thread, the whole designed to take account of a human characteristic. that the longer a man possesses an object, the more readily he grows tired of it. He craves something new. Therefore, one needs two parties. The one is in office, the other in opposition. When the one has played itself out, then the opposition party comes into power, and the party which has had its day is now in its turn the opposition. After 20 years, the new party itself has once more played itself out, and the game begins afresh. In truth, this is a highly ingenious mill in which the interests of a nation are ground very small. As everyone knows, this system is given some such name as self-government of a people. Besides this, we always find two great catchwords, freedom and democracy, used, I might say, as signboards. Freedom, under that term, is understood, at least amongst those in authority, who in fact carry on the government, the possibility of an unchecked plundering of the masses of the people, to which no resistance can be offered. The masses themselves naturally believe that under the term freedom, they possess the right to a quite peculiar freedom of motion. Freedom to move the tongue and to say what they choose. Freedom to move about the streets, etc. A bitter deception. And the same is true of democracy. In general, even in the early days, both England and France had already been bound with the fetters of slavery. With, I might say, a brazen security, these states are fettered with Jewish chains. In consequence of this widespread aversion, it was more difficult for the Jew to spread infection in the political sphere, and especially so since, traditionally, loyalty was centered in a person. The form of the state was a monarchy, and power did not lie with an irresponsible majority. Thus, the Jew saw that here it was possible for an enlightened despotism to arise upon the army, the bureaucracy, and the masses of the people still unaffected by the Jewish poison. The intelligentsia at that time was almost exclusively German, big business, and the new industries were in German hands, while the last reservoir of a people's strength in the peasantry was throughout healthy. In such conditions, if, as industry grew, a fourth estate was formed in the towns, there was the danger that this fourth estate might ally itself with the monarchy, and thus, with its support, there might arise a popular monarchy or a popular kaisertum, which would be ready and willing to give a mortal blow to those powers of international suprastate finance, which were at that time beginning to grow in influence. This was not impossible. In the history of Germany, princes had from time to time found themselves forced, as in Brandenburg, to turn against the nobility and seek popular support. But this possibility constituted a grave danger for Jewry. If the great masses of the new industrialized workmen had come into nationalist hands and, like a true social leaven, had penetrated the whole nation, if the liberation of the different estates had followed step by step in an organic development, and the state had later looked to them for support, then there would have been created what many hoped for in November 1989, viz. A national social state. For socialism in itself is anything but an international creation. As a noble conception, it has indeed grown up exclusively in Aryan hearts. It owes its intellectual glories only to Aryan brains. It is entirely alien to the Jew. The Jew will always be the born champion of private capital in its worst form, that of unchecked exploitation. Voltaire, as well as Rousseau, together with our German Fichte and many another, they are all without exception united in their recognition that the Jew is not only a foreign element differing in his essential character, which is utterly harmful to the nature of the Aryan, but that the Jewish people, in itself, stands against us as our deadly foe, and so will stand against us always and for all time. The masterstroke of the Jew was to claim the leadership of the Fourth Estate. He founded the movement, both of the Social Democrats and the Communists. His policy was twofold. he had his apostles in both political camps. Amongst the parties of the right, he encouraged those features which were most repugnant to the people. The passion for money, unscrupulous methods in trade, which were employed so ruthlessly as to give rise to the proverb, business too marches over corpses. And the Jew attacked the parties of the right. Jews wormed their way into the families of the upper classes. It was from the Jews that the latter took their wives. The result was that in a short time, it was precisely the ruling class which became in its character completely estranged from its own people. And this we get to see by the Jew, the his opportunity with the parties of the left. Here he played the part of the common demagogue. Two means enabled him to drive away and disgust the whole intelligentsia of the nation from the leadership of the workers. First, his international attitude, for the native intelligence of the country is prepared to make sacrifices. It will do anything for the life of the people. But it cannot believe in the mad view that through the denial of that national life, through a refusal to defend the rights of one's own people, through the breaking down of the national resistance to the foreigner, it is possible to raise up a people and make it happy. That it cannot do, and so it remained at a distance. And the Jew's second instrument was the Marxist theory in and for itself. For directly one went on to assert that property as such is theft. Directly one deserted the obvious formula that only the natural wealth of a country can and should be common property, but that which a man creates or gains through his honest labor is his own. Immediately, the economic intelligentsia, with its nationalist outlook, could here too no longer cooperate. For this intelligentsia was bound to say to itself that this theory meant the collapse of any human civilization, whatever. Thus, the Jews succeeded in isolating this new movement of the workers from all the nationalist elements. More and more so, to influence the masses, that he persuaded those of the right that the faults of the left were the faults of the German workmen. And similarly, he made it appear to those of the left that the faults of the right were simply the faults of the so-called bourgeois. And neither side noticed that on both sides, the faults were the result of a scheme planned by alien, devilish agitators. And only so is it possible to explain how this dirty joke of world history could come to be, that stock exchange Jews should become the leaders of a workers' movement. It is a gigantic fraud. World history has seldom seen its like. And then we must ask ourselves, what are the final aims of this development? So soon as millions of men have had it hammered into them that they are so oppressed and enslaved that it matters not what their personal attitude may be to their people, their state, or economic life, then a kind of passive resistance must result, which sooner or later will do fatal damage to the national economy. Through the preaching of the Marxist economic theory, the national economy must go to ruin. We see the results in Russia. The end of the whole economic life of the state. The handing over of the community to the international world of finance. And the process is furthered through the organization of the political strike. Often there are no adequate economic grounds for a strike, but there are always political grounds and plenty of them. And to this must be added the practical political sabotage of the state, since the thought of the individual is concentrated on the idea of international solidarity. It is clear that a nation's economic life depends upon the strength of a national state. It does not live on such phrases as appeasement of the peoples or freedom of the peoples. At the moment when no people supports the economic life of a nation, ready to give it its protection, at that moment economic life collapses. The breaking in pieces of a nation's strength is the end of a nation's prosperity. The national existence must cease altogether, and one can see constantly how wonderfully the Stock Exchange Jew and the Leader of the Workers, how the Stock Exchange Organ and the Journal of the Workers cooperate. They both pursue one common policy and a single aim. Moses Cohn, on the one side, encourages his association to refuse the workers' demands, while his brother Isaac in the factory incites the masses and shouts, "Look at them! They only want to oppress you! Shake off your fetters!" His brother takes care that the fetters are well and truly forged. The Stock Exchange Organ seeks without intermission to encourage fevered speculation and unparalleled corners in grain and in the food of the people, while the Workman's Newspaper lets off all its guns on the masses, telling them that bread is dearer and this, that, and the other is dearer. Up, proletarians! Endure it no longer, down with... How long can this process last? It means the utter destruction not only of economic life, but of the people. It is clear that all these apostles who talk their tongues out of their heads, but who spend the night in the Hotel Excelsior, travel in express trains, and spend their leave for their health in Nisi, these people do not exert their energies for love of the people. No, the people is not to profit. It shall merely be brought into dependence on these men. The backbone of its independence, its own economic life, is to be destroyed, that it may the more surely relapse into the golden fetters of the perpetual interest slavery of the Jewish race. And this process will end when suddenly out of the masses someone arises who seizes the leadership, finds other comrades and fans into flame, the passions which have been held in check, and looses them against the deceivers. That is the lurking danger, and the Jew can meet it in one way only: by destroying the hostile national intelligentsia. That is the inevitable ultimate goal of the Jew in his revolution. And this aim he must pursue. He knows well enough his economics brings no blessing. His is no master, people. He is an exploiter. The Jews are a people of robbers. He has never founded any civilization, though he has destroyed civilizations by the hundred. He possesses nothing of his own creation to which he can point. Everything that he has is stolen. Foreign peoples, foreign workmen build him his temples. It is foreigners who create and work for him. It is foreigners who shed their blood for him. He knows no people's army. He has only hired mercenaries who are ready to go to death on his behalf. He has no art of his own. Bit by bit, he has stolen it all from the other peoples or has watched them at work and then made his copy. He does not even know how merely to preserve the precious things which others have created. As he turns the treasures over in his hand, they are transformed into dirt and dung. He knows that he cannot maintain any state for long. That is one of the differences between him and the Aryan. True, the Aryan also has dominated other peoples. But how? He entered on the land. He cleared the forests. Out of wildernesses, he has created civilizations. And he has not used the others for his own interests. He has, so far as their capacities permitted, incorporated them into his state. And through him, art and science were brought to flower. In the last resort, it was the Aryan, and the Aryan alone, who could form states and could set them on their path to future greatness. All that the Jew cannot do, and because he cannot do it, therefore all his revolutions must be international. They must spread as a pestilence spreads. He can build no state and say, "See here, here stands the state, a model for all. Now copy us." He must take care that the plague does not die, that it is not limited to one place, or else in a short time, this plague hearth would burn itself out. So, he is forced to bring every mortal thing to an international expansion. For how long? Until the whole world sinks in ruins and brings him down with it in the midst of the ruins. That process today in Russia is practically complete. The whole of present-day Russia has nothing to show beyond a ruined civilization. a colony ripe for development through alien capital. And even this capital, in order to supply resources in labor for its practical work, must introduce Aryan intellects. Since for this again, the Jew is useless. Here too, he is all rapacity, never satisfied. He knows no ordered economy. He knows no ordered body of administrators. Over there in Russia, he is laying his hands on everything. They take the nobles' diamonds to help the people. The diamonds then stray into foreign societies and are no more seen. He seizes to himself the treasures of the churches, but not to feed the people. Oh no, everything wanders away and leaves not a trace behind. In his greed, he has become quite senseless. He can keep hold of nothing. He has only within him the instinct for destruction, and so he himself collapses with the treasure that he has destroyed. It is a tragic fate. We have often grown excited over the death of a criminal. If an anarchist is shot in Spain, we raise a mighty howl over the sacrifice of valuable human blood. Da, adieu. Immigadin. East, 30 million human beings are being slowly martyred, done to death. Some on the scaffold, some by machine guns. Millions upon millions through starvation. A whole people is dying, and we can perhaps understand how it was possible that formerly all the civilizations of Mesopotamia disappeared without a trace, so that one can only with difficulty find in the desert sand the remains of these cities. We see how in our own day whole countries die out under this scourge of God, and we see how this scourge is threatening Germany too, and how with us our own people in mad infatuation is contributing to bring upon itself the same yoke, the same misery. We know that the revolution which began in 1918 has covered perhaps but the first third of its course. Two things, however, there are which must scourge it forward upon its way: economic causes and political causes. On the economic side, the ever-growing distress. And in the political sphere, are not nearly all Germans in their hearts, let each one admit it, in despair when they consider the situation, which leaves us quite defenseless in face of a Europe which is so hostile to Germany? And why is Europe hostile? We see how over there, in this other Europe, it is not the peoples which agitate against us, it is the secret power of the organized press, which ceaselessly pours new poison into the hearts of these peoples. And who are then these bandits of the press? The brothers and the relatives of the publishers of our own newspapers, and the capital source which provides the energy which here and there drives them forward is the Jewish dream of world supremacy. Today the idea of international solidarity has lost its force. One can still bring men out of the factories, but only by means of terrorism. If you ask for an honest answer, the worker will confess that he no longer believes in this international solidarity. And the belief in the so-called reasonableness of the other people has gone too. How often have we been told that reason will lead them not to be too hard with us? True. Reason should have moved them thus, but what did move them had nothing to do with reason. For here there is no question of the thought of reasonable peoples. It is the thought of a wild beast, tearing, raging in its unreason, that drives all of them to the same ruin as that to which we ourselves are driven. So the masses of the people in Germany are becoming, in the political sphere, completely lost. Yet here and there, people are beginning to get some practice in criticism, slowly, cautiously, and yet, with a certain accuracy, the finger is being placed on the real wound of our people. And thus one comes to realize, if only this development goes on for a time, it might be possible that from Germany, the light should come which is destined to light both Germany and the world to their salvation. And at that point, the everlasting lie begins to work against us with every means in its power. It is said if one criticizes the state of affairs to which we have been brought today, that one is a reactionary, a monarchist, a pan-German. I ask you, what would probably have been the state of Germany today if during these 3 years there had been no criticism at all? I believe that in fact there has been far, far too little criticism. Our people, unfortunately, is much too uncritical, or otherwise it would long ago have not only seen through many things, but would have swept them away with its fist. The crisis is developing towards its culmination. The day is not far distant when, for the reasons which I have stated, the German Revolution must be carried forward another step. The leaders know all too well that things cannot always go on as they are going today. One may raise prices 10 times by 100%, but it is doubtful if in the end, even a German will accept a million of marks for his day's wage, if in the last resort, with his million wage, he must still starve. It is a question whether one will be able to keep up this great fraud upon the nation. There will come a day when this must stop, and therefore one must build for that day before it comes. And so now Germany is reaching that stage which Russia has drunk to the lees. Now in one last stupendous assault, they will finally crush all criticism, all opposition, no, rather whatever honesty is still left to us. And that they will do the more rapidly, the more clearly they see that the masses are beginning to understand one thing: National Socialist teaching. Whether for the moment it comes to them under that name or under another, the fact is that everywhere, more and more, it is making headway. Today, all these folk cannot yet belong to a single party, but wherever you go, in Germany, yes, almost in the whole world, you find already millions of thinking men who know that a state can be built only on a social foundation. And they know also that the deadly foe of every social conception is the international Jew. Every truly national idea is in the last resort social, i.e., he who is prepared so completely to adopt the cause of his people that he really knows no higher ideal than the prosperity of this his own people, he who has so taken to heart the meaning of our great song, Deutschland, Deutschland über alles, that nothing in this world stands for him higher than this Germany, people and land, land and people. He is a socialist. And he who in this people sympathizes with the poorest of its citizens, who in this people sees in every individual a valuable member of the whole community, and who recognizes that this community can flourish only when it is formed not of rulers and oppressed, but when all according to their capacities fulfill their duty to their fatherland and the community of the people and are valued accordingly. He who seeks to preserve the native vigor, the strength, and the youthful energy of the millions of working men, and who, above all, is concerned that our precious possession, our youth, should not before its time be used up in unhealthy, harmful work. He is not merely a socialist, but he is also national in the highest sense of that word. It is the teaching of these facts which appears to the Jews as leaders of the revolution today to constitute a threatening danger. And it is precisely this which more than anything else makes the Jew wish to get in his blow as soon as possible. For one thing, he knows quite well. In the last resort, there is only one danger which he has to fear. And that danger is this young movement. He knows the old parties. They are easily satisfied. Only endow them with a few seats as ministers or with similar posts, and they are ready to go along with you. And in especial, he knows one thing. They are so innocently stupid. In their case, the truth of the old saying is proved afresh every day. Those whom the gods wish to destroy, they first strike with blindness. They have been struck with blindness. Therefore, it follows that the gods wish to destroy them. Only look at these parties and their leaders, Stresemann and the rest of them. They are indeed not dangerous. They never go to the roots of the evil. They all still think that with forbearance, with humanity, with accommodation, they can fight a battle which has not its equal in this world. Through gentleness, they think that they must demonstrate to the enemy of the left that they are ready for appeasement so as to stay the deadly cancerous ulcer through a policy of moderation. No, 1,000 times no. Here there are only two possibilities, either victory or defeat. What today is the meaning of these great preparations for the decisive battle on the part of Bolshevist Judaism? To make the nation defenseless in arms and to make the people defenseless in spirit. Two great aims. Abroad, Germany is already humiliated. The state trembles before every French Negro captain. The nation is no longer dangerous. And within Germany, they have seen to it that arms should be taken away from the decent elements of the people. And that in their stead, Russian Jewish Bolshevist bands should be armed. Only one thing remains still to do, viz. The muzzling of the spirit, above all the arrest of the evil agitators. That is the name they give to those who dare to tell the people the truth. Not only are their organizations to be known to all, but the masses are to be incited against their persons. Just as the Jew could once incite the mob of Jerusalem against Christ, so today he must succeed in inciting folk who have been duped into madness to attack those who, God's truth, seek to deal with this people in utter honesty and sincerity. And so he begins to intimidate them, and he knows that this pressure in itself is enough to shut the mouths of hundreds, yes, of thousands. For they think, if I only hold my tongue, then I shall be safe in case they come into power. No, my friend. The only difference will be that I may hang, perhaps still talking, while you will hang, in silence. Here, too, Russia can give us countless examples, and with us it will be the same story. We know that the so-called law for the protection of the Republic, which comes from Berlin today, is nothing else than a means for reducing all criticism to silence. We know, too, that no effort will be spared so that the last outstanding personalities, those who within Germany foresee the coming of disaster, shall in good time disappear. And to that end, the population of North Germany will be scourged into opposition to Bavaria with every lie and every misrepresentation that comes to hand. Up there, they have the feeling that in one corner of the Reich, the spirit of the German people is not yet broken. And that is the point to which we National Socialists have to grapple ourselves. We National Socialists are God's truth, perhaps the most loyal, the most devoted of all men to our German fatherland. For 3 years, we have waged a war, often against death and devil, but always only for our German fatherland. We got so far that at the last, as crown of all our labors, we had to land in prison. But in spite of everything, there is one thing we would say. We do make a distinction between a government and the German fatherland. When today here in the Landtag, or in the Reichstag at Berlin, some lousy half-Asiatic youth casts in our teeth the charge that we have no loyalty to the Reich, I beg you, do not distress yourselves. The Bavarian people has sealed its loyalty to the Reich with its countless regiments which fought for the Reich and often sank under the earth 2 or 3 times. We are convinced, and that in the last resort is our one great faith, that out of this bitterest distress and this utter misery, the German Reich will rise again. But not as now, not as the offspring of wretchedness and misery. We shall possess, once again, a true German Reich of freedom and of honor, a real fatherland of the whole German people, and not an asylum for alien swindlers. There is today constant talk about federalism, etc. I beg you not to abuse the Prussians, while at the same time you grovel before the Jews, but show yourselves stiff-necked against the folk of Berlin. And if you do that, then you will have on your side in the whole of Germany millions and millions of Germans, whether they be Prussians or men of Baden, Württembergers, men of Saxony, or Germans of Austria. Now is the hour to stand stiff-necked and resist to the last. We National Socialists, who for 3 years have done nothing but preach, abused and insulted by all, by some mocked and scorned, by others traduced and slandered, we cannot retreat. For us, there is only one path which leads straight ahead. We know that the fight which now is blazing will be a hard struggle. It will not be fought out in the court of the Reich at Leipzig. It will not be fought out in a cabinet at Berlin. It'll be fought out through those factors which in their hard reality have ever up to the present time made world history. I heard recently in the speech of a minister that the rights of a state cannot be set aside through simple majority decisions, but only through treaty. Bismarck once used different language on this subject. He thought that the destinies of peoples could be determined neither through majority decisions nor through treaties, but only through blood and iron. On one point, there should be no doubt. We will not let the Jews slit our gullets and not defend ourselves. Today in Berlin, they may already be arranging their festival dinners with the Jewish hangmen of Soviet Russia. That they will never do here, they may today begin to set up the Cheka, the extraordinary commission in Germany. They may give it free scope. We surrender to such a Jewish commission, never. We have the conviction, firm as a rock, that if in this state 7 million men are determined to stand by their no to the very last, the evil specter will collapse into nothingness in the rest of the Reich. For what Germany needs today, what Germany longs for ardently, is a symbol of power and strength. So as I come to the end of my speech, I want to ask something of those among you who are young. And for that, there is a very special reason. The old parties train their youth in the gift of the gab. We prefer to train them to use their bodily strength. For I tell you, the young man who does not find his way to the place where in the last resort the destiny of his people is most truly represented, only studies philosophy, and in a time like this, buries himself behind his books or sits at home by the fire. He is no German youth. I call upon you, join our storm divisions. And however many insults and slanders you may hear if you do join, you all know that the storm divisions have been formed for our protection, for your protection, and at the same time, not merely for the protection of the movement, but for the protection of a Germany that is to be. If you are reviled and insulted, good luck to you, my boys. You have the good fortune already at 18 or 19 years of age to be hated by the greatest of scoundrels. What others can win only after a lifetime of toil, this highest gift of distinguishing between the honest man and the brigand falls as a piece of luck into your lap while you are but youths. You can be assured that the more they revile you, the more we respect you. We know that if you were not there, none of us would make another speech. We know, we see clearly that our movement would be cudgeled down if you did not protect it. You are the defense of a movement that is called one day to remodel Germany in revolutionary fashion from its very foundations in order that there may come to birth what perhaps so many expected on the 9th of November. A German Reich and a Germanic, and so far as in us lies, a German Republic. Every battle must be fought to the end. Better that it come early than late. And he ever stands most securely who from the first goes to the fight with the greatest confidence. And this highest confidence we can carry with us in our hearts. For he who on our side is today the leader of the German people, God's truth. He has nothing to win, but perhaps only everything to lose. He who today fights on our side cannot win great laurels. Far less can he win great material goods. It is more likely that he will end up in jail. He who today is leader must be an idealist, if only for the reason that he leads those against whom it would seem that everything has conspired. But in that very fact, there lies an inexhaustible source of strength. The conviction that our movement is not sustained by money or the lust for gold, but only by our love for the people that must ever give us fresh heart, that must ever fill us with courage for the fray. And as my last word, take with you this assurance: if this battle should not come, never would Germany win peace. Germany would decay, and at the best, would sink to ruin like a rotting corpse. But that is not our destiny. We do not believe that this misfortune, which today our God sends over Germany, has no meaning. It is surely the scourge which should and shall drive us to a new greatness, to a new power and glory, to a Germany which for the first time shall fulfill that which in their hearts millions of the best of our fellow countrymen have hoped for through the centuries and the millennia, to the Germany of the German people. Economics is a secondary matter. World history teaches us that no people became great through economics. It was economics that brought them to their ruin. A people died when its race was disintegrated. Germany, too, did not become great through economics. A people that in its own life, folkish, has lost honor, becomes politically defenseless, and then becomes enslaved also in the economic sphere. Internationalization today means only Judaization. We in Germany have come to this, that a 60 million people sees its destiny to lie at the will of a few dozen Jewish bankers. This was possible only because our civilization had first been Judaized. The undermining of the German conception of personality by catchwords had begun long before. Ideas such as democracy, majority, conscience of the world, world solidarity, world peace, internationality of art, etc., disintegrate our race consciousness, breed cowardice. And so today, we are bound to say that the simple Turk is more man than we are. No salvation is possible until the bearer of disunion, the Jew, has been rendered powerless to harm. One, we must call to account the November criminals of 1918. It cannot be that 2 million Germans should have fallen in vain, and that afterwards one should sit down as friends at the same table with traitors. No, we do not pardon, we demand vengeance. Two, the dishonoring of the nation must cease. For betrayers of their fatherland and informers, the gallows is the proper place. Our streets and squares shall once more bear the names of our heroes. They shall not be named after Jews. In the question of guilt, we must proclaim the truth. Three, the administration of the state be cleared of the rabble which is fattened at the stall of the parties. Four, the present laxity in the fight against usury must be abandoned. Here, the fitting punishment is the same as that for the betrayers of their fatherland. Five, we must demand a great enlightenment on the subject of the peace treaty. With thoughts of love? No, but in holy hatred against those who have ruined us. Six, the lies which would veil from us our misfortunes must cease. The fraud of the present money madness must be shown up. That will stiffen the necks of us all. Seven, as foundation for a new currency, the property of those who are not of our blood must do service. If families who have lived in Germany for 1,000 years are now expropriated, we must do the same to the Jewish usurers. Eight, we demand immediate expulsion of all Jews who have entered Germany since 1914, and of all those, too, who through trickery on the stock exchange or through other shady transactions have gained their wealth. Nine, the housing scarcity must be relieved through energetic action. Houses must be granted to those who deserve them. Eisner said in 1918 that we had no right to demand the return of our prisoners. He was only saying openly what all Jews were thinking. People who so think must feel how life tastes in a concentration camp. Extremes must be fought by extremes. Against the infection of materialism, against the Jewish pestilence, we must hold aloft a flaming ideal. And if others speak of the world and humanity, we say the fatherland. And only the fatherland. In the Bible we find the text, that which is neither hot nor cold will I spew out of my mouth. This utterance of the great Nazarene has kept its profound validity until the present day. He who would pursue the golden mean must surrender the hope of achieving the great and the greatest aims. Until the present day, the half-hearted and the lukewarm have remained the curse of Germany. To the half-heartedness and weakness of the parties in Parliament was added the half-heartedness of governments. So no, sir, everything stood under the sign of half-heartedness and lukewarmness, even the fight for existence in the World War and still more the conclusion of peace. And now the continuation of the half-hearted policy of those days holds the field. The people, inwardly united in the hard struggle in the trenches, there were neither parties nor confessions, has been torn asunder through the economics of profiteers and knaves. Appeasement and the settlement of differences would certainly soon be there if only one were to hang the whole crew. But profiteers and knaves are, of course, citizens of the state. And what is more important still, they are adherents of the religion, which is hallowed by the Talmud. Even today, we are the least loved people on earth. A world of foes is ranged against us, and the German must still today make up his mind whether he intends to be a free soiler or a white slave. The only possible conditions under which a German state can develop at all must therefore be the unification of all Germans in Europe, education towards a national consciousness, and readiness to place the whole national strength without exception in the service of the nation. No economic policy is possible without a sword, no industrialization without power. Today we have no longer any sword grasped in our fist. How can we have a successful economic policy? England has fully recognized this primary maxim in the healthy life of state. For centuries, England has acted on the principle of converting economic strength into political power, while conversely, political power in its turn must protect economic life. The instinct of self-preservation can build up economics, but we sought to preserve world peace instead of the interests of the nation, instead of defending the economic life of the nation with the sword, and of ruthlessly championing those conditions which were essential for the life of the people. 3 years ago, I declared in this same room that the collapse of the German national consciousness must carry with it into the abyss the economic life of Germany as well. For liberation, something more is necessary than an economic life policy, something more than industry. If a people is to become free, it needs pride and willpower, defiance, hate, and once again hate. The spirit comes not down from above. That spirit which is to purify Germany, which with its iron besom is to purify the great sty of democracy. To do that is the task of our movement. The movement must not rust away in Parliament. It must not spend itself in superfluous battles of words. But the banner with the white circle and the black swastika will be hoisted over the whole of Germany on the day which shall mark the liberation of our whole people. In our view, the times when there was no League of Nations were far more honorable and more humane. We ask, must there be wars? The pacifist answers no. He proceeds to explain that disputes in the life of peoples are only the expression of the fact that a class has been oppressed by the ruling bourgeoisie. When there are, in fact, differences of opinion between peoples, then these should be brought before a peace court for its decision. But he does not answer the question whether the judges of this court of arbitration would have the power to bring the parties before the bar of the court. I believe that an accused ordinarily only appears voluntarily before a court, because if he did not, he would be fetched there. I should like to see the nation which would allow itself to be brought before this League of Nations court in the case of a disagreement without external force. In the life of nations, what in the last resort decides questions is a kind of judgment court of God. It may even happen that in case of a dispute between two peoples, both may be in the right. Thus, Austria, a people of 50 millions, had most certainly the right and outlet to sa-a-sea. But since in the strip of territory in question, the Italian element of the population was in the majority, Italy claimed for herself the right of self-determination. Who yields voluntarily? No one. So the strength which each people possesses decides the day. Always before God and the world, the stronger has the right to carry through what he wills, history proves. He who has not the strength, him the right in itself profits not a whit. A world court without a world police would be a joke. And from what nations of the present League of Nations would then this force be recruited? Perhaps from the ranks of the old German army? The whole world of nature is a mighty struggle between strength and weakness, an eternal victory of the strong over the weak. There would be nothing but decay in the whole of nature if this were not so. States which should offend against the elementary law would fall into decay. You need not seek for long to find an example of such mortal decay. You can see it in the Reich of today. Before the war, two states, Germany and France, had to live side by side, but only under arms. It is true that the war of 1870 through 1871 meant for Germany the close of an enmity which had endured for centuries. But in France, a passionate hatred against Germany was fostered by every means, by propaganda, in the press, in school textbooks, in theaters, in the cinemas. All the Jewish papers throughout France agitated against Berlin. Here again, to seek and to exploit grounds for a conflict is the clearly recognizable effort of world Jewry. The conflict of interest between Germany and England lay in the economic sphere. Up till 1850, England's position as a world power was undisputed. British engineers, British trade, conquer the world. Germany, owing to greater industry and increased capacity, begins to be a dangerous rival. In a short time, those firms which in Germany were in English hands pass into the possession of German industrialists. German industry expands vastly. And the products of that industry, even in the London market, drive out British goods. The protective measure, the stamp made in Germany, has the opposite effect from that desired. This protective stamp becomes a highly effective advertisement. The German economic success was not created in Essen alone, but by a man who knew that behind economics must stand power, for power alone makes an economic position secure. This power was born upon the battlefields of 1870-71, not in the atmosphere of parliamentary chatter. 40,000 dead have rendered possible the life of 40 millions. When England, in the face of such a Germany as this, threatened to be brought to her knees, then she bethought herself of the last weapon in the armory of international rivalry, violence. A press propaganda on an imposing scale was started as a preparatory measure. But who is the chief of the whole British press concerned with world trade? One name crystallizes itself out of the rest. Northcliffe, a Jew. A campaign of provocation is carried on with assertions, libels, and promises such as only a Jew can devise, such as only Jewish newspapers would have the effrontery to put before an Aryan people. And then at last, 1914, they egg people on. Ah, poor violated Belgium. Up to the rescue of the small nations for the honor of humanity. Same lies, the same provocation throughout the entire world. And the success of that provocation, the German people can trace grievously enough. What cause finally had America to enter the war against Germany? With the outbreak of the World War, which Judah had desired so passionately and so long, all the large Jewish firms of the United States began supplying ammunition. They supplied the European war market to an extent which perhaps even they themselves had never dreamed of. A gigantic harvest. Yet nothing satisfied the insatiable greed of the Jew. And so, the venal press, which depended upon the stock exchange, kings began an unparalleled propaganda campaign. A gigantic organization for newspaper lying was built up. And once more, it is a Jewish concern, the Hearst press, which set the tone of the agitation against Germany. The hatred of these Americans was not directed solely against commercial Germany or against military Germany. It was directed specially against social Germany, because this Germany had up to that time kept itself outside of the principles which govern the world trusts. The old Reich had at least made an honorable attempt to be socially minded. We had to show for ourselves such an initiative in social institutions as no other country in the wide world could boast. This explains why, even in Germany itself, the comrades under Jewish leadership fought against their own vital interests. This explains the agitation carried on throughout the world under the same watchword. For this reason, the Jewish Democratic Press of America had to accomplish its masterpiece. That is to say, it had to drive into the most horrible of all wars a great peace-loving people, which was as little concerned in European struggles as it was in the North Pole. America was to intervene in defense of civilization, and the Americans were persuaded so to do by an atrocity propaganda conducted in the name of civilization, which from A to Z was a scandalous invention, the like of which has never yet been seen, a farrago of lies and forgeries. Because this last state in the world where social aims were being realized had to be destroyed, therefore 26 peoples were incited, one against the other, by this press which is exclusively in the possession of one and the same world people of one and the same race, and that race on principle, the deadly foe of all national states. Who could have prevented the World War? Not the Kultur Solidarität, the solidarity of civilization, in whose name the Jews carried on their propaganda. Not the so-called world pacifism, again, an exclusively Jewish invention. Could the so-called solidarity of the proletariat? All the wheels stand silent still, if that be your strong arm's will. The German wheel on November 9th, 1918, was indeed brought to a standstill. The Social Democratic Party, in its principal organ, Vorwärts, declared in so many words that it was not in the interest of the workers that Germany should win the war. Could the Freemasons perhaps stop the war? This most noble of philanthropic institutions, who foretold the good fortune of the people louder than anyone, and who at the same time was the principal leader in promoting the war. Who, after all, are the Freemasons? You have to distinguish two grades. To the lower grade in Germany belong the ordinary citizens who, through the claptrap which is served up to them, can feel themselves to be somebodies. But the responsible authorities are those many-sided folk who can stand any climate, those 300 Rathenaus who all know each other, who guide the history of the world over the heads of kings and presidents, those who will undertake any office without scruples, who know how brutally to enslave all peoples. Once more, the Jews. Why have the Jews been against Germany? That is made quite clear today, proved by countless facts. They use the age-old tactics of the hyena. When fighters are tired out, then go for them. Then make your harvest. In war and revolutions, the Jew attained the unattainable. Hundreds of thousands of escaped Orientals become modern Europeans. Times of unrest produce miracles. Before 1914, how long would it have taken, for instance, in Bavaria, before a Galician Jew became prime minister, or in Russia, before an anarchist from the New York ghetto, Bronstein Trotsky, became dictator. Only a few wars and revolutions, that was enough to put the Jewish people into possession of the red gold, and thereby to make them masters of the world. Before 1914, there were two states above all, Germany and Russia, which prevented the Jew from reaching his goal, the mastery of the world. Here, not everything which they already possessed in the Western democracies had fallen to the Jews. Here, they were not the sole lords alike in the intellectual and economic life. Here, too, the parliaments were not yet exclusively instruments of Jewish capital and of the will of the Jew. The German and the genuine Russian had still preserved a certain aloofness from the Jew. In both peoples, there still lived the healthy instinct of scorn for the Jew. And there was a real danger that in these monarchies, there might one day arise a Frederick the Great, a William the Fates, and that democracy and a parliamentary regime might be sent to the devil. So the Jews became revolutionaries. The Republic should bring them to wealth and to power. This aim they disguised. They cried, "Down with the monarchies! Enthrone the sovereign people!" I do not know whether today one could venture to call the German or the Russian people sovereign. At least one cannot see any trace of it. What the German people can trace, however, what every day stands in the most crass form before its eyes, is debauchery, gluttony, speculation ruling unchecked, the open mockery of the Jew. So Russia and Germany had to be overthrown in order that the ancient prophecy might be fulfilled. So the whole world was lashed into fury. So every lie and propaganda agency was brutally set in action against the state of the last, the German idealists. And thus it was that Judah won the World War. Or would you wish to maintain that the French, the English, or the American people won the war? They, one and all, victors and vanquished are alike defeated. One thing raises itself above them all, the World Stock Exchange, which has become the master of the people. What guilt had Germany herself for the outbreak of the war? Her guilt consisted in this, that at the moment when the ring closed about her existence, Germany neglected to organize her defense with such vigor that through this demonstration of her power, either the others, despite their abominable purposes, would have been robbed of their will to strike, or else the victory of the Reich would have been assured. The guilt of the German people lies in this, that when in 1912, a criminal Reichstag, in its unfathomable baseness and folly, had refused to allow the raising of three army corps, the people did not create for itself those army corps in the Reichstags, despite. With these additional 120,000 men, the Battle of the Marne would have been won, and the issue of the war decided. 2 million fewer German heroes would have sunk into their graves. Who was it who in 1912, as in 1918, struck its weapons from the hands of the German people? Who was it that in 1912, as in the last year of the war, infatuated the German people with his theory that if Germany throws down her arms, the whole world will follow her example? Who? The democratic Marxist Jew, who at the same hour incited and still today incites the others to arm and to subjugate barbarous Germany. But someone may perhaps yet raise the question whether it is expedient today to talk about the guilt for the war. Most assuredly, we have the duty to talk about it. For the murderers of our fatherland, who all the years through have betrayed and sold Germany, they are the same men who, as the November criminals, have plunged us into the depths of misfortune. We have the duty to speak, since in the near future, when we have gained power, we shall have the further duty of taking these creators of ruin, these clouts, these traitors to their state, and of hanging them on the gallows to which they belong. Only let no one think that in them there has come a change of heart. On the contrary, these November scoundrels who still are free to go as they will in our midst, they are even today going against us. From the recognition of the facts comes the will to rise again. 2 millions have remained on the field of battle. They, too, have their rights, and not we, the survivors, alone. There are millions of orphans, of cripples, of widows in our midst. They, too, have rights. For the Germany of today, not one of them died. Not one of them became a cripple, an orphan, or a widow. We owe it to these millions that we build a new Germany. I reject the word proletariat. The Jew who coined the word meant by proletariat not the oppressed, but those who work with their hands. And those who work with their intellects are stigmatized bluntly as bourgeois. It is not the character of a man's life which forms the basis of this classification. It is simply the occupation, whether a man works with his brain or with his body. And in this turbulent mass of the hand workers, the Jew recognized a new power, which might perhaps be his instrument for the gaining of that which is his ultimate goal. World supremacy, the destruction of the national states. And while the Jew organizes these masses, he organizes business too, at the same time. Business was depersonalized, i.e. business lost the Aryan character of work. It became an object of speculation. Master and man were torn asunder. And he who created this class division was the same person who led the masses in their opposition to this class division, led them not against his Jewish brethren, but against the last remnants of independent national economic life. And these remnants, the bourgeoisie, which also was already Judaized, resisted the great masses who were knocking at the door and demanding better conditions of life. And so the Jewish leaders succeeded in hammering into the minds of the masses the Marxist propaganda: your deadly foe is the bourgeoisie. If he were not there, you would be free. If it had not been for the boundless blindness and stupidity of our bourgeoisie, the Jew would never have become the leader of the German working classes. And the ally of this stupidity was the pride of the better stratum of society, which thought it would degrade itself if it condescended to stoop to the level of the plebe. The millions of our German fellow countrymen would never have been alienated from their people if the leading strata of society had shown any care for their welfare. You must say farewell to the hope that you can expect any action from the parties of the right on behalf of the freedom of the German people. The most elementary factor is lacking: the will, the courage, the energy. Where then can any strength still be found within the German people? It is to be found, as always, in the great masses. Their energy is slumbering, and it only awaits the man who will summon it from its present. Slumber and will hurl it into the great battle for the destiny of the German race. The battle which alone can liberate Germany will be fought out with the forces which well up from the great masses. Without the help of the German working man, you will never regain a German Reich. Not in our political salons lies the strength of the nation, but in the hand, in the brain, and in the will of the great masses. Now as ever, liberation does not come down from above. It will spring up from below. If we today make the highest demands upon everyone, that is only in order that we may give back to him and to his child the highest gift: freedom and the respect of the rest of the world. The parties of the right have lost all energy. They see the flood coming, but their one longing is just for once in their lives to form a government. Unspeakably incapable, utterly lacking in energy. Cowards all such are all these bourgeois parties, and that at the moment when the nation needs heroes, not chatterers. In the left, there is somewhat more energy, but it is used for the ruin of Germany. The communists, on principle, reject the discipline imposed by the state. In its stead, they preach party discipline. They reject the administration of the state as a bureaucracy, while they fall on their knees before the bureaucracy of their own movement. There is arising a state within the state which stands in deadly enmity against the state which we know, the state of the community of the people. This new state ultimately produces men who reject with fanaticism their own people, so that in the end, foreign powers find in them their allies. Such is the result of Marxist teaching. What we want is not a state of drones, but a state which gives to everyone that to which on the basis of his own activity he has a right. He who refuses to do honest work shall not be a citizen of the state. The state is not a plantation where the interests of foreign capital are supreme. Capital is not the master of the state, but its servant. Therefore, the state must not be brought into dependence on international loan capital. And if anyone believes that that cannot be avoided, then do not let him be surprised that no one is ready to give his life for this state. Further, that greatest injustice